I want you to picture something for a second. Imagine you are sitting in a movie theater.
Okay.
It's dark, the screen is huge, and the movie is just incredibly realistic. You see trees, you see people, you know, you see the sun. But here is the catch.
There's always a catch.
Right. You are handcuffed to the seat. You can never leave the theater. You can never go outside to actually check if the trees or the sun are real or if they just exist as pixels on that screen.
I mean, that is a terrifying image. It's essentially the plot of The Matrix.
Yeah.
Just 200 years before they actually made the movie.
Exactly. And the crazy thing is, for a long time, this wasn't science fiction. This was the absolute cutting edge of European philosophy. You had the smartest people in the world, guys like Descartes, Locke, Hume, basically telling everyone, hey, you know that world you think you live in?
You can't prove it's there.
Yeah. They said you are just watching the screen inside your head.
It was a period of really profound skepticism because the theory of ideas, or representationalism as it's called in the sources, had everyone convinced that we are trapped behind this wall of our own perceptions. We don't actually see the world. We just see ideas of the world. And if that is true, you eventually hit a wall where you have to ask, does anything exist outside of my own mind?
Which is the ultimate existential crisis, right? But today, we are doing a deep dive into the guy who finally stood up and said, okay, this is getting ridiculous. We are talking about Thomas Reed and the Scottish Realists.
The heroes of common sense.
Yes. And, you know, when we hear the phrase common sense today, we just think of basic street smarts.
Like, don't put a fork in the toaster.
Exactly. But for Reed and the Edinburgh Circle in the late 18th century, common sense was a rigorous philosophical weapon. It was the tool they used to basically smash that movie theater screen and put us back in touch with reality.
And we have a really great stack of sources for this today. We've got lecture notes, historical analysis, and Reed's own writings. Our mission here is to explore exactly how Reed went to war against David Hume's skepticism. We'll look at why Reed thought doubting your own existence wasn't a sign of being a genius, but actually a sign of a disorder.
And we will see why this matters so much, because this wasn't just some local Scottish debate. This philosophy traveled across the Atlantic. It basically took over Princeton University, shaped American thought, and even laid the groundwork for modern analytic philosophy. Guys like G.E. Moore in the 20th century.
Right. So let's start with the problem Reed was trying to fix. We mentioned the movie theater analogy earlier. In the notes, this is referred to as the theory of ideas.
What exactly was the logic here? Like, why were people like Locke and Descartes so convinced we couldn't just see the real world?
Well, it actually starts with a biological fact. They knew that when you look at a tree, you aren't literally putting the tree inside your brain. Right. Light hits your eye, a physical signal goes to your mind, and your mind creates an image. So Descartes and Locke argued that the immediate object of your perception isn't the physical tree itself. It is the image of the tree, the idea.
Okay, so the idea is playing the role of a middleman.
Exactly. The mind is a theater. The ideas are the actors on the stage. And the real world is somewhere outside the building. But the problem is, if you are stuck in the audience, you can never get backstage to compare the actor to the real person. You can never know for sure if the idea matches the reality.
And that gap, that space between the image and the reality, is where David Hume really set up shop.
Oh, absolutely. Hume was the ultimate skeptic. He basically said, look, since you can't ever check the reality, you can't know anything for sure. You don't know if the sun will rise tomorrow. You don't even know if you have a self. You're just a bundle of random perceptions.
He really took that logic to its absolute breaking point. And reading the history, it seems like it honestly paralyzed philosophy. It made human knowledge seem impossible.
Enter Thomas Reed. Reading through his work, you definitely get the sense that he respected Hume. But he also thought this whole line of thinking was totally absurd.
Reed's argument is so refreshing because he doesn't just argue within their framework. He challenges the very premise. He says, wait a minute, who said the mind is a theater? Who said ideas are these little things that we look at?
Right. He calls the whole theory of ideas a fiction. A story that philosophers just told themselves until they got lost in it.
He has this fantastic argument involving a rose that completely dismantles the idea theory. I love this part of the source material because it's so simple, but it's so hard to argue with.
It is the rose analogy. It's brilliant. So the philosophers say, when you smell a rose, you aren't smelling the actual rose itself. You are perceiving a mental idea of a smell.
And Reed just asked, does an idea have a smell?
Exactly. Can a thought smell like flowers? No. An idea is a mental concept. It has no scent at all. But the real rose does have a scent.
He does the same thing with the sun, doesn't he? He says, my idea of the sun isn't a giant ball of burning gas. My idea of the sun doesn't hurt my eyes if I think about it too hard. But the actual sun does.
His whole point is logical consistency. If the qualities of the object, the scent, the brightness, the heat, aren't present in the idea, then claiming that we only perceive the idea is nonsense. It completely falsifies our experience. When you smell a rose, you aren't smelling a mental image. You are smelling the rose.
This is what the notes call direct realism.
Yes, or epistemological monism, if you want the really technical term. But direct realism is much easier to digest. It means the object is presented to us, not represented by some middleman. There is no screen. When you look at the world, you are actually seeing the world.
But I have to play the skeptic for a second here, because I know you, the listener, are probably thinking this right now. What about when I close my eyes and I just imagine a rose? That is an idea. I'm not smelling a real rose in that moment. So ideas definitely exist.
And Reed completely agrees with that. He doesn't deny that ideas exist. He denies that they are the barrier between us and reality. This is a subtle but really brilliant shift in thinking. Reed says an idea isn't an object you look at. It is an act of the mind you look through.
Okay, that sounds nice in a textbook, but what does it mean practically?
Think of the idea as a sign or a window. When you see smoke, your mind immediately goes to fire. You don't sit there staring at the smoke and analyzing it as a painting. You look through the smoke to the reality that it signifies.
Oh, I see.
Reed says our sensations are just signs. The smell of perfume is a sign that passes your attention directly to the person wearing it. The idea is just the vehicle. It's transparent.
So the earlier philosophers basically made the mistake of painting over the window and staring at the paint instead of looking through the glass.
That is a perfect way to put it. Reed is saying, stop staring at your own mind and just look at what your mind is showing you.
Which leads us right to the heart of his philosophy, which is common sense. And we established earlier, this isn't just street smarts. What is the technical definition he's working with here?
In the context of Scottish realism, common sense refers to natural beliefs. These are beliefs that are deeply rooted in the intrinsic constitution of human nature. They are basically part of our hardware.
The lecture notes have this hilarious bit where Reed just absolutely roasts Descartes. Remember, Descartes famously doubted his own existence to find truth. I think, therefore I am. He thought that was the absolute height of wisdom.
Reed did not share that opinion.
Not at all. Reed writes that a man who seriously doubts his own existence isn't a philosopher. He says he's as unfit to be reasoned with as a man who believes he is made of glass.
It is savage, but it's very clinical. Reed is making the point that skepticism about basic reality isn't a deep intellectual position. It's a disorder in the human frame. If you truly, genuinely believe you might be made of glass or that the floor you're standing on isn't real, you don't need a philosophical debate. You need a doctor.
It totally changes the playing field. He's saying there are certain things we are just built to believe. We don't even have a choice in the matter.
Spontaneous and involuntary.
Yeah.
That's exactly how he describes these natural beliefs. We don't choose to believe the sun exists.
Yeah.
We just do. And this brings in the theological aspect, which is huge for the Scottish realists. Why do we have these unavoidable beliefs?
Because they were installed by the manufacturer.
Right. Reed argues these beliefs are implanted by the creator. God designed our faculties, our eyes, our reason, our senses to track with reality. If our eyes were constantly lying to us, that would make God a deceiver. And Reed completely rejects that.
It's interesting, though, because Hume noticed the exact same thing, didn't he? Hume said, look, we all act on instinct. A horse eats hay because it has a biological instinct to eat, not because it has some philosophical proof that the hay exists.
Yes, but Hume thought that was a blind, irrational instinct. Reed agrees that it's instinct, but he says it is a justified instinct. It's not blind. It's designed. It is a guidance system. If you feel a natural urge to trust your memory or to believe that the future will resemble the past, you should trust it. That is just your operating system working correctly.
So we've established that the world is real and we can trust our senses. But Reed had to fight an even bigger boss battle. He had to prove cause and effect.
This is the really heavy lifting, because Hume had completely dismantled this idea. Hume argued that we never actually see causation.
The famous billiard ball example.
The classic. Hume says, look at two billiard balls on a table. Ball A hits ball B. Ball B moves. What did you actually see? You saw motion. You saw contact. And you saw more motion. But did you see the physical power that made ball B move? Did you see the cause itself? No, you just saw a sequence of events.
And Hume's point was that we can't objectively prove there's any real power connecting them. It's just our brains expecting the second ball to move based on past experience.
Which is devastating for science, if you think about it. Science is all about explaining causes. If cause is just a figment of our imagination, physics basically falls apart.
So how does Reed fix this? If we can't see the power in the billiard balls on the table, where do we find it?
We find it in ourselves. Reed pivots entirely to agency. He argues that we have a direct awareness of causal power because we are causes.
There is this great example in the source material from Dr. Holmes involving sacks of salt. I want to use that because it's just so visceral.
It's such a great example. Imagine you are carrying 2 40-pound sacks of water softener salt, one in each hand. You are walking from the trunk of your car to the garage. Your muscles are burning. Your grip is slipping. You are tottering along the driveway.
I know that exact feeling. You are fighting gravity with everything you have.
Reed says, focus on that feeling. You are directly aware of the effort you are exerting. You feel the power you're using to keep those heavy sacks in the air. You aren't inferring it from a sequence of events. You aren't theorizing about it. You are directly experiencing agency causation.
So, because I know that I have the power to make things happen, like literally lifting the salt, I understand what power actually is in the rest of the universe.
Exactly. We project our internal knowledge of power onto the outside world. We know the billiard ball has force because we know what it feels like to personally apply force.
This connects directly to free will, doesn't it? Because if Hume is right and everything is just balls hitting balls, then we are just dominoes. We don't actually make choices. We just react to whichever motive is strongest.
Hume was a determinist in that exact sense. He thought our actions were mathematically determined by our motives. But Reeve says, look at your own experience again.
The agony of choice.
Yes. Think about a time you had to make a really hard decision, maybe a major career change or a serious moral dilemma. You feel the pull of different motives. You feel the struggle.
If I were just a machine running a pre-written program, there wouldn't be a struggle. A computer doesn't stress out about which line of code to run next. It just runs the strongest one.
Precisely. The fact that we have to exert active effort to choose between motives proves to Reed that we are active agents. We aren't just being pushed around by our desires like billiard balls. We are sitting in the driver's seat.
There is a connection here to G.E. Moore, a much later philosopher that I really like in the sources. The notes call it the paradox of the philosopher.
It's the ultimate hypocrisy test. You have a philosopher who writes a dense, brilliant book arguing that time is an illusion, but then the absolute moment he finishes writing, he checks his watch because he doesn't want to miss his train.
Or the guy who argues that other people are just projections of his own mind, but then gets deeply offended if you insult him.
Reed and Moore would both say, trust the practice, not the theory. If your grand philosophy contradicts the way you actually have to live your life to survive, your philosophy is wrong. Life is the test.
That is such a grounding idea. Life is the test. And that brings us to the final frontier Reed tried to reclaim, which is ethics. Because if you can't trust your senses and you don't have free will, then right and wrong are basically just fairy tales.
Hume was very consistent here, too. He argued that morality is just a sentiment. It's just a feeling. If you see a terrible crime, you don't literally see wrongness floating in the air. You just feel a negative emotion in your gut. So for Hume, morality is entirely subjective.
But Reed wants to turn ethics into a science. He talks about first principles of moral.
He treats ethics a lot like geometry. In geometry, you have axioms, self-evident truths, like a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. You don't have to formally prove them. You just look at them and see that they are true. Reed says morality works the exact same way.
The notes use this beautiful metaphor of a seed.
Reed argues that moral judgment is an imperceptible seed planted by the Creator in the human mind, and it grows as we mature. He actually agrees with Hume that feeling is involved. We definitely have emotional reactions to good and evil. But he insists it is feeling plus judgment.
So when I say it is wrong to hurt an innocent person, I'm not just saying I don't like that. I'm stating a fact.
You are perceiving an objective moral truth. Reed lists some of these basic truths, like we ought to prefer a greater good to a lesser good. He says these are just self-evident to anyone reasoning properly.
But what about people who don't see it? We all know people who seem to have absolutely no problem doing terrible things. Does that disprove his rule?
Reed would say no. If someone looks at a bright red stop sign and says, that's gray, we don't say, oh, well, I guess color is subjective. We say, you are colorblind.
Moral colorblindness.
Exactly. If someone literally cannot see the basic principles of right and wrong, it doesn't mean those principles aren't really there. It means there's a defect in that specific person's moral vision.
It all comes back to that same foundational confidence. Trust your eyes to see the world. Trust your agency to move the world. And trust your conscience to judge the world.
It really is a philosophy of empowerment. Scottish realism tells you that you are well-equipped for reality. You don't have to sit around second-guessing your basic humanity.
It's no wonder this took off the way it did in America. The notes mention that this became the standard go-to philosophy at Princeton.
It was huge over there. When you think about the early American spirit pragmatic, action-oriented, believing in self-evident truths, that has Scottish realism written all over it. It shaped the theology and the politics of the new nation. It was practically the official philosophy of the American academic world for almost a century.
And it bridged the gap right into the 20th century. G.E. Moore, who we mentioned earlier, really picked up that torch to fight against the next wave of modern skepticism.
It's a cycle. Philosophy just tends to drift into these abstract, nothing is real phases, and then someone like Reed or Moore has to come along and snap everyone back to reality.
So as we wrap this up, I really want to leave you, the listener, with that friction between theory and practice. Because we all have ideas we think we believe, maybe about politics or religion or the nature of truth itself.
But the real test isn't what you say in a clever debate. It's what you do when you leave the room.
You look both ways before you cross the street. You get angry when someone lies to your face. You feel the physical weight of the grocery bags. You live your life as if the world is real, as if people matter, and as if your choices actually count.
And if there is a conflict between your abstract theory and your daily life, the common sense of your life is usually the one telling the truth.
Don't let a philosophy textbook talk you out of what you already know is true. Thanks for taking the plunge with us today.
Always a pleasure.
We'll see you on the next deep dive.